If you're new here, we're basically going through the big story. And this is basically just a simplified phrase for the idea of a meta-narrative. And when we kind of introduced this idea of the big story, we were looking at introducing this idea of postmodernism that we talked about, of a generation and a whole lot of people within probably more of the Western world that have an outlook that is postmodernistic in the way they interpret truth and the way they interpret stories. And so we looked at a guy, I think he was a philosopher, I think his name was Jean-François Lyotard or something like that, but he basically loosely defined postmodernism as an incredulity towards meta-narratives. And so what that basically means is that you have people who have adopted this sort of perspective and worldview, whether they know it or acknowledge it or not, they've adopted this postmodernistic way of seeing the world, often relativistic. You have a truth, I have a truth, you know, that's your truth, it's not mine. You can all have your individual truths. It doesn't matter if they're contradictory, and that's just this idea of relativism, but there is no overarching truth. There is no overarching meta-narrative. In other words, there's no other story that can stand over them all and say, this is the story of which you belong, of which your little story, your narrative belong to. And so it's kind of ironic in many ways that we are choosing to step into this long season of going through this big story, because you would think that, well, with so many people having these ideas and they have this skepticism and this disbelief and sort of an open rejection, sometimes even a hostility towards the idea of a meta-narrative, especially one that has a capital T, T-H-E, the meta-narrative, and says, this is the story, and there is no other that can stand over it. And that's how the Bible speaks. That's how the Bible presents truth. And to a postmodern world that is so influenced by these types of thinking, that is really pretty much openly rejected. And yet we're choosing to go through this meta-narrative, through this big story of the Bible, basically God's story, because we believe that this actually has great potential to impact our lives, no matter where we're coming from with our worldview. And one of the things about postmodernism that people have mentioned is that most postmoderns do accept narratives. In other words, they accept the small stories. If I come with my story, you can accept that as my story, as long as I don't say it's a meta-narrative. As long as I don't say, well, my truth overrides your truth. As long as I say, this is only mine, and you can do whatever you want. So it's kind of every man for himself with truth. So with that, people do tend to embrace the idea of stories, to embrace the idea of my own personal story and smaller stories, little narratives. And really, when we look at this big story, and if you've been with us for a while going through this, you've seen that this big story is really just a collection of little narratives, of little stories, of little people seemingly insignificant, most of them really pretty messed up, pretty much all of them pretty messed up for the most part in one way or another. Some of them absolutely crazy, and some crazy things that have gone down through these stories that make up this big story, and yet God continues to be faithful. And I think one of the beautiful things about presenting these little stories is that as we move through looking at the forest and not the trees, and as we get sort of a grand view, you know, of what God has done, we begin to see a unified picture. And so even though we're looking at all these little narratives, we're actually seeing that this is one cohesive story, and it is in fact a meta-narrative. And so in some ways we're almost sneaking it in through these little stories. And one of the things that I've learned over the years that I've grown to love and have a deep passion for is my conviction that this is a unified story. That it isn't just a fragmented book of random stories about random people doing things where God pops in once in a while to see what's going on and twiddling his thumbs as if, how am I going to fix this? This is something that reveals an ongoing plan of God from the very beginning with a whole lot of messed up people along the way. And one of the things that I believe that we should be picking up on and seeing if we are doing a decent job teaching this big story, and if you guys are listening, hopefully both of those things, is a sense of anticipation, because this story begins to build right from the beginning. God creates the world, everything's good, and then through rebellion, humanity enters into sin. And from the very beginning, we see this promise made by God, that we see from the very beginning there's this hope that spoken to Eve, spoken to Adam and Eve, that the seed of the woman would come and crush the head of the serpent. So the serpents come in, he's led them in deception, sin, corruption, death has entered the world, and we see all the problems that follow throughout our lives and history and throughout all of these stories. But God is already, from the very beginning, saying, I'm going to make this right, and it's going to come through the seed of the woman. And that seed will come and crush this work of the devil. It will crush the serpent's head, though his heel will be bruised. And so it's pointing forward from the very beginning to the Christ that would come. And we've seen this big story as an ongoing rescue operation of God. And so what we end up having is kind of what I've experienced with TV shows that I like, that you kind of get hooked into, especially if you're watching, you know, Amazon, Netflix, Hulu. You get into these shows and they get interesting, and then bam, they end on a cliffhanger. And you're like, oh man, I can't believe it ended like that. And so, you know, it's like, oh, it's 10 o'clock, we better watch the next episode. We need a resolve, right? You watch the next one, cliffhanger again. And I found that they do that with a lot of these good shows, and you can't stop watching them. So we haven't done this lately, but there are times where we'd pick up on a show and be like, 2 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I've got to see one more episode. We'll be okay, you know, really bad habit. But you just have to see what's going to happen. And pretty much most of the time what happens is you get to the end of the season, and the biggest cliffhanger of all gets landed on you, and you have to wait till the next year to see what's going to happen. But I kind of feel like that's what we experience over and over, is this ongoing sense of anticipation of, when is this going to resolve? Like, all of these stories keep going. It keeps looking like it's totally going south. God's rescue plan is pretty much thwarted by just the sin and the stupidity of humanity and their disobedience, and yet God proves himself faithful over and over, but it's never resolved. It's always pointing forward to, like, next season. It's always, like, out there in the distance. And I believe that's what we're going to see today, like all the other stories. We're going to look at the book of Ruth. We've been in the book of Judges. The book of Ruth takes place during the time of the Judges. But what I want to remind us of is as we're seeing and feeling, hopefully, the sense of anticipation, as this big story doesn't resolve, is it should be building in us what I believe everyone who was witnessing these things, everyone who was reading the Old Testament, should have been having built in themselves, so that by the time you get to the New Testament, for all of these years, the promise finally comes in the person of Jesus Christ. The anticipation should have been, he's finally here. It's finally here. Finally, the answer to all of these stories has come. And in truth, there were people who did anticipate that, and they recognized him, but that wasn't really how it went for the majority. You know, you had people who would have known the scriptures, known the stories, and yet when Christ came on the scene, they'd be standing before him crying out, crucify him, not recognizing that the promise had come. And I think for us, as a people of faith, as a people who follow God, it's so important to get our picture of God from all of Scripture, from the Old Testament and the New, because the Old Testament sets us up for what's in the New Testament. You know, I don't know how he worded it exactly, but Augustine, to loosely paraphrase him, basically said something like, the New Testament is in the Old concealed. So it's hidden there in type and shadow. The New Testament is in the Old concealed, but the Old Testament is in the New revealed. And we see that as a truth that Paul talks about in Ephesians, where he speaks of the mystery that was hidden for ages and is now open. It's broken open so we can see it. But I think that if all we do is go to the New Testament, it's like going to the end of the season, and you watch the last episode of the season, but you didn't follow the character development. You didn't experience the emotions of what it meant to get there, so that really means something when you get to that last end of the road. If all we do is read the end chapter, which is important, and I think the New Testament is extremely important because we have the gospel so clearly defined and the mystery is revealed. So we need the New Testament, and we need to read the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament, of understanding the gospel, meaning good news. We see the good news, we see the promise of fulfillment, and we read the Old Testament through that lens. But it's so important to get our picture of God from all of Scripture, from this big story, and see the interconnectedness so that when we see these things, they have a greater depth of meaning in our lives. And we begin to know, I believe, a little more of the character of God. We begin to know a little more of what He's like. We don't adopt the wrong ideas like some of the new atheists, for instance, who would say, the God of the Old Testament is malicious and malignant, and they just go on this tirade against Him. But they don't say that about the God of the New Testament. It's like they don't really see what's going on. And I think it's easy for Christians to do the same thing. You look at the wars, you look at the judgments, you look at some of the horrific things, you look at a difficult book like Judges that we were just lightly covering, and you stumble over all the, what's going on here? Or what is God doing? Or God seems severe. But what we end up often missing by not tying these two together and reading one through the lens of the other, we often end up missing the absolute mercy of God towards humanity. And I believe that is one constant that we see through all of the Bible. In everything God does, we see immense patience and we see absolute mercy given to sinful humanity that constantly rejects Him. And so that's just kind of my intro to what we're doing with this big story. And we're going to delve into the book of Ruth and look at this little story that, again, points us forward in anticipation to the fulfillment of the greater things that God is doing. So the book of Ruth comes right after the book of Judges. Again, this is taking place during the time of Judges. It's four chapters long. We're going to kind of just skim through the whole book really fast. Hopefully we have enough time. But I believe that this is a beautiful story. I really love the book of Ruth, and I think this is a love story, and it's so many things, and it points us forward to something truly greater. But basically, the book of Ruth takes place during the time of Judges. There's a famine in the land. If you remember Judges, everyone is doing what's right in their own eyes. There's lawlessness. There's chaos. There's no king in Israel. And continually, the people end up back into sin. They get judged by God. God's disciplining them, and then He sends judges or sort of leaders, like military leaders, to come in and deliver them from oppression. And this cycle of madness continues. And the people here in Bethlehem, where this is taking place, are living in a time probably coming from God's judgment. I don't remember that it says that, but clearly they keep going into these seasons where God is disciplining them. And yet God's promises still stand, that He had promised this land to them, and that they were called to inherit this land and trust Him to keep them in this land and protect them from their enemies and fulfill His promises. But basically during this famine, we're introduced to this character, Elimelech, his wife Naomi. And Elimelech decides that the wise thing to do would be to leave the promised land during this famine and go over to the land of Moab where there's food. And so essentially what we see is that Elimelech is stepping outside of trusting God. It looks like there's no hope for them. And instead of trusting God because God had promised them this land and promised to be their God, he goes like we often do ourselves and finds his own way to provide for his family. And that quickly goes south. Right away in the first chapter, we see that Elimelech dies and leaves his wife Naomi as a widow. Well, then it tells us that she has two sons, and these two sons marry Moabite women. They're there for about 10 years, it says, but the two sons die. And so what we have is Naomi as a widow, and we have her with her two daughters-in-law, and all the men are dead. Now, in this time, to not have a husband wasn't necessarily a good thing economically, and in so many ways, even culturally, it would be a desirable thing to have a husband, to have children, to be provided for in that way, much different than our perhaps more egalitarian society today. And so in many ways, these women were in trouble, needing to figure out what they were going to do, I think. So basically, in chapter 1, verse 6, we find out that Naomi hears in the fields of Moab that God has visited his people back in Bethlehem or back in Israel. God has brought them food again. So the famine seems to be over. And here she is without a husband. Her daughters-in-law have no husbands. And she decides it's time to go home. It's time to go home where there's food. They had gone to this other place, but it wasn't really where she belonged. In truth, the Moabites were considered a detestable people. The Moabites were considered enemies of God's people. Even in the book of Judges, we see Eglon, an enemy from the Moabites. We see Balak hiring Balaam to curse God's people. Again, Moabite tension. We see in Deuteronomy 23 that the Moabites are spoken of as not even entering in to be amongst the people. And yet, there's obviously an exception to that as we look at the book of Ruth. And I believe that it points us to the reality that God's heart is that outsiders are welcome. But it doesn't change the fact that there were people who in sin and faithlessness came against God's people. And God was dealing with them because God had specific plans. And so the Moabites were not considered necessarily in any way a people that would be respected, a people that should be friends with Israelites. They came from descendants of really just sin. Lot ends up being made drunk by his daughters. They had grown up in Sodom where he had brought them, and they were raised around a pretty corrupt society. And next thing you know, the oldest daughter has had a child by her father, who she tricked, and out of that was born Moab. And so these are the descendants coming from incest, from all this thing, this stuff. And so this wasn't a land that the Jewish people who were given promises should have been moving to. And these weren't a people that were necessarily accepted. And so Naomi's going to go home, and I'm prefacing kind of the Moabite tension there because I think that's an important part of this story. But basically, she heads out. Verse 8, she's going, and her daughter-in-laws seem to be following her, and she says to them, "Go return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." And so basically, and then she says, "The Lord grant you that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." And so she's saying, you need husbands. You should go back to your mother's house. You don't want to come, you know, as a Moabite. You don't want to come to Israel. This isn't going to be good for you. You already don't have husbands, and it's probably doubtful anybody's going to marry them as Moabites. And so that would be a bad situation gone worse. And so out of her concern for them, she says, you know, go home and go to your mother's house. Find yourself husbands. Basically, you know, take care of yourselves. And she kind of has a given up on herself kind of a thing. She says, you know, I'm too old to have a husband. Even if I did, you know, and I had sons, would you wait for them to grow up? Like, basically, I'm a lost cause. Just leave me alone. And you see the reaction of these two daughters-in-law. Out of love for her, they weep, it says. And so they're crying. And it says that in verse 15, they lift up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And so what we see here is that they both were concerned with Naomi, but Orpah, one daughter-in-law, ends up deciding, you know, the right thing to do is going to be to stay here. And she ends up leaving Naomi. But right away we're introduced to this person, Ruth, and even her character, where she clings to her mother-in-law in love. And her mother-in-law goes on in verse 15, Naomi, and says, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." So she's still trying to urge Naomi to go. She's still urge Ruth to go. She's still concerned with Ruth, that the best thing for her is going to be to stay in the land of Moab, go back home to her mother, and try to find a husband. But Ruth won't have it. And I just want to say, when it comes to this character of Ruth, as we look at this person, there's something amazing and beautiful about Ruth. Sort of a disclaimer is I don't like to preach what is referred to as exemplary messages from the Old Testament. And what those are is you find an Old Testament character, and they're exemplary in character. There's something that stands out about them. And then you preach that as, look at this exemplary character. And it ends up lending itself to moralism. And what that basically would look like is we look at King David. Oh, what a king. What a warrior. What a man of faith. What an amazing person. Look at the courage of David against Goliath. Be like David. And it's not always wrong. I mean, should we have that kind of faith when he went up against Goliath? Yes. But most of the time, that breaks down and doesn't focus on what these passages actually are pointing to, the greater reality of what God is doing. And most of the time, that has a tendency to lend itself towards moralism, where we say, look at this person and all the good things they do. Go out and be a good person and do good things. And we miss the fact that none of us really are good people. We're called to grow in holiness. We're called to grow in being followers of Christ. But none of us are going to get in by our works. And so we don't want to go down that path. We want our works to be an outworking of the natural relationship we have with God through Christ, resting on what He has done and finished on our behalf. And so even saying that, though, I do believe that Ruth is an exemplary character. And it's so tempting to just preach a message on, look at Ruth, she's awesome. Because she really is. She's a unique character in the Bible. She's something else. And so right away we see that Ruth rejects Naomi's call for her to go back home. And Ruth says in the next verse, verse 16 of chapter 1, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. And then come some of the most beautiful words, poetic words that you've probably heard in the Bible. You've heard them in weddings. You've heard them in movies. You've probably recognized these. This is what Ruth says to Naomi. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So Ruth is basically saying, like, you're going to have to kill me. I'm going to go with you. Nothing but death will separate me from you. She's showing her love for her mother-in-law. She's putting her own life and her livelihood, her any opportunities she has for her best life now are going to go out the window. She's taking a big risk here out of love for her mother-in-law to see her taken care of. And she's saying some really beautiful things here, that she's going to go with her. She's going to go and call Naomi's people her people. And I believe Ruth knows the implications of that. I think we see that in other parts of reading this story. She's going to make Naomi's God her God. And this is I think, something that even points to this growing faith in Ruth, in the God of the Israelites. She even names the Lord, Yahweh, the name for the Israelite God, not just God in general. She says that the Lord do so to me and more, if anything but death parts me from you. And here is Naomi, having gone out to the Moabite land, kind of a move following her husband, probably not from faith, it doesn't seem like. And yet, somehow along the way, it seems that Ruth is picking up that there's something to this God of Naomi. That Naomi was still saying, you know, God has visited His people. That's why there's food back in Israel. And that's why we should go there. And your God's going to be my God. And I think that if we pay close attention to this whole story, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to see that Ruth is being adopted into the family of God's people and becomes someone who is looking to God in faith for her redemption. So basically, they head home. Ruth follows her. Naomi gets back. People are like, hey, is this Naomi? They haven't seen her in a long time. And she's like, oh, just call me Mara, you know, the word for bitter. You know, I went away full, but God has brought me back empty. And she's just kind of bummed, like there's nothing here. And yet, Naomi, again, is not really maybe seeing things through the eyes of faith, because I don't think she knows what a good deal she got with Ruth, who God gave to Naomi, of what a blessing Ruth will be in Naomi's life. She has no idea yet. And then in chapter 2, we're introduced basically to this character, Boaz. So here's Ruth and Naomi. They're back in Israel. They're back in Bethlehem. And it says in the first verse of chapter 2, now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And so we're introduced to Boaz, and we're also told that he's a relative. And so not only that, we're told about his character or what kind of man he is. It says that he is a worthy man. In the Hebrew, this is the word gibor or ish gibor for worthy man. It's the same word or phrase that comes up when we're told about David's mighty men of valor in other parts of the Bible. And we see these mighty men of valor were something amazing. You know, if you see like a movie like Troy where you have the Achilles character and he's going out there and he's just this amazing warrior. And he has this small group of men called the Myrmidon, and they just go in. It doesn't matter that there's thousands of other soldiers. They go in and they take care of business. These are mighty warriors, and that's kind of what you picture with David's mighty men. You see accounts where it's like one guy takes out a couple hundred other warriors. I mean, these guys were like hardcore. And so there's this picture right away in this language, even if it's translated worthy men. There's this idea that Boaz is a man of valor. It speaks of him in high regard, using this Givor term that's speaking of mighty. There's something unique about Boaz right in the beginning. And we're told that he's a relative of her husband. So she's probably going to be coming back, being a widow, and having Ruth as a widow, looking for relatives that might help them out in their desperate situation. And so what we see is immediately in the next verse, Ruth basically says, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And so right away, Ruth is beginning to, again, take care of Naomi, her mother-in-law. She is going to go out and do the work. She's going to try to get food, perhaps put herself at risk as a Moabite. Even in that verse, it says that the Moabite said to Naomi. We're being reminded that she's going out in the field of Israelite people, and she's a Moabite who, in the time of the judges, where everybody's doing what they want, there's not necessarily much law and order, she's in a bit of danger, again putting herself at risk. It's just a beautiful picture of Ruth's character and her love for Naomi. So she goes out to the field of, and she's gleaning in the different fields, but she comes to the field of Boaz, the field belonging to Boaz, and Boaz notices her, and he asks his young man in verse 5, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came and she continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." So the guys tell Boaz that that's who she is. And Boaz's response to Ruth in the next verse is, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women, and let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." And then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And so right away we're introduced to another little glimpse of Boaz's character. And I believe, go read these chapters and pay close attention to this, I believe that this is the beginning of a love story that is evolving here. Boaz hears about Ruth coming from the foreign land, and she's taking care of her mother-in-law, and he's basically being what I think we'll see in a moment, is this type of Christ, this type of Redeemer. He's a picture of a Christ character. And that's often what we see in the Old Testament, is these types and shadows of Christ. And I think Boaz is that. We see that Boaz is a provider. He ends up feeding her. He ends up telling the young men, "Don't touch her." So he becomes her protector. He is a leader. He's an affluent landowner. He has men and women under him. He has his young men and he has his women gleaning out in the field. He is compassionate. He's concerned for Naomi. He's moved by Ruth's love and sacrifice for Naomi, and he even cares for Ruth. So we see his character as this unique person who ends up helping out their situation. And he basically is saying, you know, "Stay here, I'll take care of you. Like, you're going to be safe here. You know, stay with the women, don't go with men. Like, do what's safe, drink water." And then it goes on in the next verse. And basically, this is Boaz's response to Ruth saying, like, "I'm a foreigner. Like, I know I'm a Moabite, basically. Like, why are you helping me?" And this is what Boaz says. "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Now make note of that. We're going to come back to that term, "under whose wings you have come to take refuge." But we're going to move on. But basically what we see is Boaz has noticed the character of Ruth. He has seen that in her story that she has made some major sacrifices to care for Naomi, and this is his answer to her of why he is helping her out as a foreign woman. He's moved by what she's done. He's moved by what he sees in her, and he's even saying, "The Lord repay you, because you've come here to take refuge under the God of Israel." So I think this is kind of neat, because as the story progresses, what we see is kind of this ongoing love story, I think. I don't think it's just this utilitarian thing of people trying to get what they want, but I think you see Boaz noticing the character of Ruth. And I think, you know, young people, this is how relationships need to start. It needs to start in more of these friendship relationships where you're seeing the character of another person, of a worthy man. Like, be looking, women or young ladies, for a man of valor. Men or young men, be looking for a virtuous woman. And there's nothing wrong with being attracted to the person that you may marry or have a relationship with there. But if that's all there is physical attraction, that's not the way to start a healthy relationship. Too often people, it's like, you know, a young guy walks in the room and it's like, who's the most attractive person here that will also like me? That's not the way to start things out. It's such a better way to be moved by the character of a person, because our bodies are going to fade, but like, we're going to be with that person and their character is what's going to matter, especially someone who loves the Lord. And so I think we see that here. Like, Boaz is moved by Ruth and he's like, "The Lord repay you." It's pretty cool. Then it goes on at mealtime in verse 14. Boaz says to Ruth, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied and she had some left over. And when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So you see this, like, he's passing her bread, and here, have a little wine. I mean, he's taking interest in her. It's like it seems like he's impressed with her, and he's kind of going out of his way. And then he's telling his guys, like, "Well, I don't want to humiliate her. You know, we're not going to just give her this charity case thing. So what we're going to do is, you guys are going to pull out from your sheaves, and she's going to pick that up. We're not going to even tell her, it seems like." That's what seems to be going on. And so he's providing for her. He's saying, you know, let her even glean among the good parts. There was provision within the laws of the Israelites for people who had less to be able to come in and glean among the corners of the fields. I don't remember exactly what that looked like, but there were these provisions made for people that had less. And so she had the ability to do that. But Boaz is saying, let her even come in and reap among the better areas. And he's saying, pull out from your bundles and leave stuff for her. So he's providing for her in a way, again, where she is not just getting a handout, where she's able to not be humiliated by that. And he's got this concern for her. So it's pretty cool. She probably doesn't even know that. And so in verse 17, it says, she gleaned in the field until evening. And then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, and she took it up and went into the city. And so, before we close the sermon, I am running out of time, so I don't know how much time I'll spend on it, but we're going to look at just a connection here between Proverbs 31 and the book of Ruth, or Ruth as a character. And I think even this is one of those little links that you can look at later, where she goes into the city, she's doing this work. It's kind of a cool thing, but I'll get there in a second. Hopefully I'm not going around too much. I'll close this up and I think it'll make sense. But basically she gets back. She's got the food. She sees Naomi. Her mother-in-law sees what she's gleaned. She's been able to go and take stuff in the city. She's providing for their family. She's doing all this stuff. And then Naomi basically asks, you know, whose field were you in? Like, who gave you all this food you came back? Like, Ruth's already satisfied and Naomi's just eating the leftovers and there's plenty for both of them. And she says, "Oh, it's, you know, Boaz's field." And it's like Naomi's like, light bulb, you know, hey, this guy's related to us. It's like opportunity. And you kind of see Naomi step into gear in this next part where from the commentaries and things I've read, it could be interpreted in different ways because it's kind of vague as to what's going on there. But what does seem to be clear is Naomi sees an opportunity and she's trying to move after an opportunity that could present itself for Ruth to get herself a husband. Now, Naomi does basically say in verse verse 20 says to Ruth, the man is also a relative of ours and one of our redeemers. So she's recognizing that Boaz is a relative, but also a redeemer. Now, this idea of redeemer in the Old Testament is what's often referred to as a kinsman redeemer. And what it was that there was, if there was a woman who died, her husband died, and she was left alone, that there was a relative who could marry her, carry on the lineage for that family, and redeem the land. And so this was a kind of a provision made for people in this situation. And so she's saying, like, he's a redeemer. Like, there's an opportunity here. This guy could, you know, marry you, and he'll carry on the line for our family. And so that's basically what's taking place. So Naomi seems to devise this scheme. She tells Ruth, you know, like, basically, go tonight. You're going to lay at the feet of Boaz and uncover his feet. And so this is the part where you're like, like, okay, are you putting Ruth in harm's way? Are you trying to seduce this guy, you know, middle of the night and all this stuff? It doesn't look good. And I don't know really what Naomi's thinking. I think what Naomi sees is this end goal of, you know, a healthy relationship. But she's certainly, even in the lack of clarity within this, she's certainly at least, whether intentionally or not, putting Ruth at some risk, I think. And yet at the same time, I think that there's a good chance that Naomi is also betting on the character of Boaz, because she's seen Boaz, she's heard the thing, she's seen that he's like protected her, and she probably knows a bit about him, and she's betting on his character and thinking this guy can be the redeemer. And I think that this is again a picture of what we end up doing as people coming into faith. At the end of the day, though this is a flawed picture, the real picture is that we bet on the character of God through faith. We bet on his promises. We believe through faith. We don't see it as something we can just reach out and grab, but we see what God is doing. We see his promises. We believe that he has an answer to our problems. We believe that he can cover our sins. We bet on his character. We bank on his promises. And we look to him to be our redeemer. And so basically, chapter 3 brings us into this scene. Ruth basically does everything Naomi tells her to do, with maybe one exception. And so she tells Ruth, verse 4, chapter 3, then go and uncover his feet and lie down and he will tell you what to do. So she's just saying, like, go there, he'll tell you what to do. And that's the part where Ruth does everything that Naomi tells her, except for that part, where waiting on him to tell her what to do. And I think this is again pointing to Ruth's character, where something vague is turned into something clear, because Ruth makes it clear what her intentions are. So let's look at verse 6, chapter 3. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay there at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And so this is the part where she was supposed to just lay there and wait for him, according to Naomi, to tell her what to do. But she doesn't. She turns a vague situation into something clear and says, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." Now, I said, you know, make note of verse 12, where Boaz said to her, "The Lord repay you for what you have done. A full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." This is the exact same word in the Hebrew. It is kanap. And basically, I think what she's doing here is she is reminding Boaz of what he has already stated to her. The word kanap in Hebrew can be translated the corners of your garment. If you have my Bible, it even says it right down there in the footnotes in the ESV. It can also mean corners of the garment. Semantically, it flows better to say wings, but it makes more sense, as I'll demonstrate in a sec, that it means corners of your garment. And so he's saying, like, you've come here to take refuge under the God of Israel in chapter 2:12, and the Lord should repay you. And it's like she's saying, spread your wings over your servant. In other words, what you said in the way that God should repay me, be that hand of God to me, Boaz. It's like, how much more could she hint without saying, like, marry me, you know, doing the proposal? And so she knew that was what Naomi was after, but she avoided a situation by making it clear what her intentions are. And Boaz catches on when you look at his response. He gets it. He says in verse 10, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first in that you have not gone after young men." He's not missing this, whether rich or poor. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." Now, I want to stop here and just make a little clearer this idea of the wings, of why I believe it is the corners of the garment. John Piper basically did a search on this phrase in all the Bible to see where this would come up in the context of two people in love, and he only found it one other place besides where we're at in this passage, and it's in Ezekiel 16, verse 8. I'm going to read verse 4 through 8. And this is God speaking to his people in the context of them being a faithless bride and reminding them where they have come from and what he has done for them. So there's a hint of his judgment coming or his discipline coming, but this is what he is saying to the Israelites through the prophet Ezekiel. Chapter 16, verse 4, God says, "As for your birth, on the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling clothes. No eye pitied you to do any of these things to you out of compassion for you. You were cast out on the open field, for you were abhorred on the day that you were born. And when I passed by you, I saw you wallowing in your blood, and I said to you, 'In your blood, live.' I said to you, 'In your blood, live.' I made you flourish like a plant of the field, and you grew up and became tall and arrived at full adornment. Your breasts were formed and your hair had grown, yet you were naked and bare. And when I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you, and I covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you, and I entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord, and you became mine." And that's what this is. That's the exact same word there when it says, "I spread the corner of my garment." And in this culture, it was traditional within the marriage vows that the husband would take the corner of his garment and spread it over his bride. And that's the picture that Christ is painting here to the Israelites. "This is what I did for you. I covered you with my garment. I made you mine. I married you. I entered into a covenant." That's what marriage is. "I made you a part of me. I made my vow to you, and I covered your shame and nakedness." And that's what God does. He takes us as outsiders, just like Ruth, and he becomes that to us in being our Redeemer. And that is how Boaz points us forward to this reality of Christ. Is Boaz is the Redeemer, but he's just a human redeemer for a single individual. At the end of the day, Christ is the one who will take us and cover our nakedness and shame, who sees us in our blood wallowing and says to us, "Live." And he does it to us for us freely. That's what the gospel is. That's why the gospel is good news, because I don't have to work every day trying to do it for myself. He's done it for me. And that's what this anticipation of all these things leads us forward to. And that's exactly what's taking place here. I believe, as Ruth is saying, spread the corner of your garment over your servant. And Boaz doesn't miss it. Crystal clear, "I'll do this for you." He gets it. He understands what's going on. And he says, "I will do for you all that you ask for me, for my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." I'm going to have to wrap it up here because getting going long. But basically, there's another cool thing here that's in the Hebrew where it speaks of her as a worthy woman. This is the word, you know, we talked about Boaz being Ish Gibor, this mighty man of valor. But here it says she's a worthy woman. And in the Hebrew, it's this word, Isha Chayel. Now, there are scholars who have pointed out that this word only comes up three times in the Bible. In all of Hebrew, this only comes up three times. And it comes up twice in Proverbs and once here. In this exact phrase, Miles Van Pelt, Ian Duguid of Westminster have shown that there's a link between Proverbs 31, this picture of a godly woman, and Ruth, and that we are in fact meant to understand Ruth as the Proverbs 31 woman. When we look at the order and arrangement of the Hebrew Bible, it was arranged differently than our English Bibles. I think God is sovereign over the way these have gone together. It makes sense that Ruth comes after Judges, the same time frame. But in the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, where it was arranged by the law, the writings, and the prophets, Proverbs comes right before the book of Ruth. And so you read, if you were reading this in Hebrew, you read and you see this term, Isha Ha'el, and you see, oh, her works praised her in the gates, right? She's going to the town, like similarity. And she's this virtuous woman, and she's also a woman who is fit to be married to a king. And that's where we're even moving in this story, towards the lineage of kings. That's how the book of Ruth ends. And so God takes this book of wisdom, that's what the book of Proverbs is, and he caps it off with a godly woman. And then we're revealed what that looks like in this character of Ruth. And I guess that's the exemplary part. But it is a beautiful thing that she is this amazing woman, that she's this godly woman, that she shows a godlike character in the way she sacrifices and loves her mother-in-law. And this is what Boaz takes notice of. All the townsmen know. Your works praise you in the gates. They know that you are an Isha Ha'el. They know that you are a worthy woman. And this isn't spoken of any other woman in the Bible. It's an amazing connection. And basically what I think this paints the picture of is not only Boaz as a redeemer and a type of Christ, but just the beauty of what God can work through in the way that he works through us. In that he can take an outsider and he can bring them in. And he can take someone from whatever background they come from, whether you're from questionable background of whatever. Just like Ruth, she didn't come from a noble people or a well-thought-of people. She came from people who were considered outsiders, and she was brought in. And not only that, when we see the ending of the book of Ruth in the fourth chapter, we see in verse 13 that she's given a son. And she bears this son. Basically, his name is Obed. It says that Naomi takes this son and she's got her on her lap. And then it continues in verse 17 and it says, they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And so that's where we're going next, is King David. It's exciting to look at the kings and what that's going to be about. But it's not just pointing forward that he would take a foreign woman and put her in that lineage, just like Rahab the prostitute. God brings in outsiders from backgrounds that are, they're like the scum. And he puts them in the lineage of the greatest man that's ever lived. And that's what Ruth is. She's not only in the lineage of King David, but she's in the lineage of the King of Kings. Read the first chapter of Matthew and you see that down through this line comes Jesus the Christ. He is the seed that was promised from the very beginning. And that's what all of this picture, this love story, points us forward to. That's the anticipation. Yes, we can learn things about a godly woman through Ruth, but the main point is Jesus. And that's what the main point of every story that is interwoven in this big story is that this book is God's story. And the question for us is, how does my story fit in with God's story? Because they do intersect. And that is good news. There's hope in that. There's hope for anyone. So I should wrap up now. But basically, the invitation is open no matter where you've come from. We enter in based on what God has done. We put our faith in Jesus Christ. By grace through faith, we trust in his promises like everyone has come before. But we have a clear picture. Unlike those in the Old Testament who saw it through type and shadow, we see it clear. And the invitation stands that no matter where you've come from, no matter what is behind you, whether yesterday or this morning on your way here, there's nothing stopping you from trusting in Jesus and knowing him as your Redeemer and receiving freely forgiveness for our sins because he went the distance. He who knew no sin became sin for us, and he's nailed it to the cross. He is the door and he's the answer to everything. This is the meta-narrative and the story that we belong to, and it's one worth believing in. It's one worth not rejecting and accepting and learning about so that we can know God, because he is the only hope for humanity. That's the reality. He's the only hope for me as a sinner, and he's the only hope for any of you. So let's pray. Lord, I just thank you for your word, that there's so much here. There's so much to be revealed that offers us hope, and it's all pointing forward and pointing us to Jesus, pointing us to hope and life in you. And I pray that we'd be strengthened in our faith. We'd be strengthened to love your word, to to be in it more, to see your promises and trust them, to know more about your character, and if we haven't known you, to come to know you this very moment. And with our heart believe and be justified, and with our mouth confess and be saved and be named among the people of God, just like Ruth. And so I just pray your blessing on God's people today as they go out. In Jesus' name, amen.